From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll get two perspectives on the worsening crisis in Syria. We'll talk global policy with contributor Art Sear, and then speak with two Syrian activists and artists who hope the arts can do for Syria what policy and politicians can't seem to.
This art is much more readable for people. So they read it, they understand it. Above all, they trust it. And they throw their hopes on this art, on this young people, young generation.
But the political divisions within Syria are also reflected in the art.
In Syria, unfortunately, we have two kinds of art. One art pro-Assad and one art pro-humanity.
Later, we'll dive into the sea of moons that surround the planet Neptune, including the newest one not yet named. And we'll learn about a new quarterly poetry reading series taking place in Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us this morning. The humanitarian crisis continues in Syria, where a protracted war by President Bashar al-Assad's regime on opposition groups has resulted in thousands of deaths and millions of displaced Syrians who fled to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda operatives were reportedly behind a massive prison break in Iraq and have been sending fighters into Syria as well. Art Sear is our regular foreign policy contributor. He's director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. And he tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich it's hard to predict the direction the Syria crisis will move next.
The Assad regime has proven to be remarkably durable as well as brutal, and that's no surprise. It is important to have a regional perspective. And from that perspective, the massive prison break in Iraq does open the door, since it was engineered by a wing of the very loosely organized al-Qaeda operation, loosely organized but lethal al-Qaeda operation. I think the role of Islamic extremists and fundamentalists in Syria will probably continue to grow as it has in Iraq.
At some point, and this is a question that always strikes me in situations like this, when does a government start to, or a leader, start to wonder about what's left to govern? I mean, at a certain point, with so many of its citizens gone and with so much instability, why would you even want to stay in power?
Well, the alternatives for Assad and immediate associates and family members is not all that promising. So, and I think nationalism and perhaps more positive motivations are there, but sheer survival. And also the regime, compared to some others in the tumultuous Middle East today, the regime has held up pretty well, actually. They may well endure short term, but the long term trend is undeniable. It's toward overthrowing these dictatorships and toward some form of, albeit tumultuous, representative government.
What do you make of the West's continued approach in Syria? And what more could countries such as the U.S. be doing or ought to be doing?
I don't think there's much that we can do. I believe one of President Obama's strengths is great caution and care concerning direct employment of military force overseas. The Assad regime is a bad regime, thoroughly evil from our moral point of view, and probably pretty corrupt. But just because we want to overthrow them doesn't mean that the alternative would be better. I think it's extremely important for us to keep in mind that our ability to influence events in foreign countries, especially in such a culturally distant part of the world, is limited.
So, in short, you're saying that the negative consequences well outweigh the positive ones, even in terms of preventing a larger humanitarian crisis?
Yeah. In terms of direct intervention, we have proven that we can protect our interests. A couple of years ago, the Israelis very effectively took out, by airstrikes, an ominous nuclear facility that the Syrians were building with the help of North Koreans. I'm confident that, as usual, U.S. as well as Israeli intelligence was involved in planning the strikes. But it shows that when our basic national interests are concerned and alliance interests are concerned, we can't protect them, even in a dangerous and quite alien and ugly environment like Syria.
So let's move a little southwest to Egypt. You talked about tumultuous democracy. The military is still running the show after ousting President Morsi in a coup earlier this month. Morsi's family accuses the military of kidnapping him. His whereabouts are still kind of questionable.
Right.
Is there any hope for the future of democracy in Egypt, or have things permanently gone back to the way they were before those first democratic elections there?
No, I think what's going on in the Middle East is part of a widespread global change dating from the American and French revolutions. We've discussed this before. I don't want to get too academic or repetitious now, but I think pressure for representative government is over the long term unavoidable. Again, what's most important, I think, for Americans is to look to our national interests. And there the Camp David Accords, the basic peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, as far as I know, they've held. Our Israeli friends have complained about Egyptian tank movements, which Netanyahu argues have been contrary to the agreement. But I'm not sure that's true. Our Israeli friends are usually complaining about something in terms of their security. As long as Camp David holds, I think that shows that we have an essentially responsible government in Egypt from the viewpoint of American interests. The Egyptian military, I'm not in favor of military dictatorships and takeovers, but the military is traditionally strong, essentially responsible, basically not corrupt, strongly reflecting their British training and heritage. I don't think it's completely negative that the army is currently in charge, albeit the kibosh been put on democracy temporarily.
Well, and there have been demonstrations both in support of and against Morsi in recent days.
Right.
And the anti-Morsi demonstrations have often taken an anti-American tack as well. What do you make about the implications for continued relations with the West?
I think given the economic importance of the West and the economic importance of long-established relationships and the fact that the Suez Canal remains, as it has been since it was built in the 1800s, a basic global trade artery, Egypt has to remain involved with the West. I think we Americans are a lot more sophisticated than we used to be, internationally speaking, and that's all to the good. We've always been good-hearted, but we like to see the world in terms of good guys and bad guys. I don't want to blame John Wayne, but I mean, we have a culture that tends to oversimplify diplomatic complexities, and it's good for us to see that in the Midwest, in the Mideast, as in the Midwest, there's not just good guys and bad guys in competition.
That is our view from the Midwest, anyhow.
Right. Perhaps more than other parts of the country, you're quite right.
Let's move to China, if we can.
Sure.
There's reportedly been a crackdown on activists in China, not the first time, probably not the last time. But does that fly in the face of the Chinese government's recent claims of weeding out corruption among its own leaders?
No, I don't think the two are necessarily inconsistent. It remains an authoritarian regime. But they're under tremendous pressure, partly because of the pervasive importance of the internet and global media, as well as commerce. Both dimensions create tremendous pressure for transparency. And the Chinese, if they want to continue to make money, and they've got to make money if that regime is going to survive, they're in a difficult dance of trying to preserve control at the same time open up to a degree. I think much more serious is the likelihood that the Chinese economy will slip into something like recession from the fantastic growth they've enjoyed over the last couple of decades. Slowdown in construction of government buildings, I think, is in some ways the most significant indicator of change of all in China. But I do think something like dictatorship can coexist with more and more representative government on the mainland for a long time.
The rest of the world, and the U.S. in particular, slipped into its recession some time ago.
Right.
Does it just take that long for it to catch up to China?
Possibly. I'm not an in-depth expert on the detailed trends, but I think your point is very perceptive. The global financial collapse wasn't as serious as it might have been in 2007 through 2009 and into 2010. Partly because we are a globally integrated financial as well as trade system. And not just China, but Asia generally didn't fall into recession. They really helped keep the global engine moving. Just as when the Asian financial collapse occurred in 97, it didn't translate into a global recession or even collapse then, because China, as well as to some extent Japan, were essentially impervious to that wider collapse. And because, to his credit, Bill Clinton and then Secretary of the Treasury Bob Rubin engaged in some very, very effective executive action to minimize the impact of the financial collapse in Asia.
And to perhaps somewhat happier news.
I hope so.
Let's talk briefly about the royal baby. Let me ask you this. Is there any significance to the arrival of the royal baby in England, aside from the headlines it gives to the tabloids for the next 40 or 50 years?
Well, it's not just the tabloids. It's the serious press. The Wall Street Journal this morning has a rather perceptive, in-depth guest editorial about the importance of the royal family. And it's not just the tabloid population, but even NPR. We're talking about it now that pays attention to this. Walter Bagehot, B-A-G-E-H-O-T, was the editor of The Economist for 17 years back in the 1800s. He wrote a book called The English Constitution, in which he developed at length the point that we have dignified and efficient functions in our country. Thankfully, they're separated. We have government, parliament, the prime minister, cabinet. The people don't attach much passion to them because we have the monarchy, which has very limited power, but which is a target of all the emotional dimensions of politics. One challenge for the Americans is that we don't have a monarchy, which is why, at least since the Second World War, we have had this basically, I think, positive, not particularly harmful fixation on the royal family. But who is king or queen in the royal in Britain does have a global political impact because there's so much interest in the monarchy and because of their influence.
This is kind of the notion of the royal family as a global emotional safety valve.
That's well put, yes. I think you really summed up my long-winded answer. And it can be serious, all kidding aside.
You were just in England, and
yes.
this is a huge deal for the collective British psyche.
That's right. And it reflects, I think, why, because of this emotional attachment, it reflects why the monarchy has survived so long. It can be serious with very negative consequences, depending on who's on the throne. In the 30s, Edward VIII abdicated as King of Britain and was succeeded by George VI, who is rightly admired and celebrated in the successful film The King's Speech. Edward VIII, the public story was he had married an American divorcee of questionable background and blah, blah, blah. The real reason that there was a cross-party coalition, including the monarchist Winston Churchill, to get rid of him was that he was pro-Nazi. He was a very strange, eccentric person. He liked to play dress-up. He loved his cowboy outfit from Tom Mix. But what he really liked was his Nazi regalia, which he'd gotten from those fine chaps in Berlin. You can imagine what the impact might have been, quite negatively, not just for the British Isles and Empire and Commonwealth, but for all of us if this character had stayed on the throne.
But all of that is behind us, and we can all start to obsess over what the latest royal heir will be wearing when he makes his first public appearance.
Yeah, well, one never knows what's going to happen in the world. 1913, people looked ahead to endless progress in the 20th century, referring to the past that isn't so distant. Speculation that's reasonable is that Queen Elizabeth has stayed on the throne so long. She's now in her 80s because she's very good at it. She's very responsible compared to some of her screwball relatives. Prince Charles, who's, we're not making any direct comparisons with the monarch we were discussing, but he's very offbeat and unusual, that she's holding out maybe for William to take over at some point, which seems to make sense. And the more this positive traditional family image between him and Kate and the new baby can be reinforced, why the better. We can make fun of them, and the British make fun of them, but it is a serious institution with some influence, especially when there's a crisis.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad we could talk about the British.
Art Sear is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and the Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us periodically to talk about foreign policy. Coming up next, we'll talk with two Syrian artists, activists, and political refugees about their experience of the crisis in Syria and how they hope art will make a difference. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we spoke with Lake Effect contributor Art Sear about the escalating humanitarian crisis in Syria. Our next guests are Syrian artists and activists who now make their home in the United States. Forced to leave Syria because of the danger to themselves from the escalating conflict there, celebrated painter and writer Fadia Afashay and actor Jay Abdo, who are also married, work from this country to support the rebel cause against the Assad regime. Afashay and Abdo were in Milwaukee last week to speak to and work with a group of high school students attending Global Action Through Engagement, a program that is hosted on the WUWM campus by the Institute of World Affairs. They were able to stop by the studio then. Fadia and Jay, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you both here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You are both artists. Fadia, you're a painter. Jay, you're an actor. With a situation like Syria, what can you express and get people to understand through your art that diplomats can't do?
I think arts in general have
a very much bigger impact on people than a word or sometimes politicians speaking or newspapers or the news, etc. And I know from my country that so many people were affected more by videos or by paintings or by TV shows we've made or we've done way much more than were affected by news or other people speaking. So I think that art must be always active, and especially during the revolution, our revolution, so many naive artists moved people. So you imagine how can specialists or talented people do. So I noticed that in our country, people are very anxious to art, and they accept it, they receive it, and they read it. Well, that's why so many artists were persecuted and tortured, and sometimes they fled the countries in order not to be detained or anything else.
And that is true for you. You left the country.
Yes, we had to. Yeah.
You had to leave. Was it a real fear that you would be persecuted and found?
Yes, it is a real fear. Actually, it's a fear for any activist. And now the art is connected with activism because, you know, the first message of any art should be the pulse of the society. And if there is no the pulse of the society, it's not art anymore. Without a message, we cannot pretend and tell people that we are an artist. And this is my point of view, that art should be with a message telling the suffering of the people and express the things we cannot express in our ordinary life. And this is what happened in Syria. I discovered lately that we have a lot of artists in Syria. We have a lot of young artists. They will never be able to express their feeling. But now, after what happened in Syria, suddenly you discover a huge amount of art. You can find it in the network, all kind of art, the visual art, painting, poetry, theater, everything. You find people start to express and start to just show their talent coming from their suffering, coming from their need to express and talk. And art is the perfect way to express it, and actually it's the perfect way to tell a message of the population. Because no matter what politician, as Jihad said, take the lead and talk about our suffering, we need to give the right pulse of our people. And we are the people. We are the people. That does mean we are the artists. Everyone now, I consider every single artist in Syria, even I call now people who just write some words in the graffiti, in the wall, in the walls, in the city, I call them artists. Why? Because now, for me, I appreciate the message more than the art itself. And this is how I see the art now. I have changed my point of view about art after the revolution in Syria have totally changed. I was thinking of art and using art, to be honest, in a selfish way. I was expressing my own feeling. Sometimes I was committed to some small things like the women's rights, doing some art for women's to express their suffering in our society. But now my point of view have totally changed. I start to see new art, new kind of art. And I think it's a kind of new movement in the art. It's a new movement when you hear the rap, the new rap of the new artist, when you see the new cartoons and movies in YouTube, when you just see some young people who just take a picture and videos for demonstration and post it online, I see an art on that.
So it's almost the message,
yes,
is so much more important, mm-hmm, than the actual medium,
yeah,
that is being,
yeah,
used.
Yeah. So I think this is change. That the history will recognize this movement of art in the future as they recognize the school of Impressionists. And I believe this is a new kind of art now emerged from the new movement of the population.
Do you think that artists in Syria, is this happening right in Syria, or is this happening more through people like you who have had to leave? I mean, is it both?
It is both. It is both. But inside Syria, artists must hide and must work underground. Politicians in Syria, which is the government, is so afraid and so concerned about those artists because people don't trust the politicians anymore. And this art is much more readable for people. So they read it, they understand it, and above all, they trust it. And they throw their hopes on this art, on this young people, young generation?
The government in Syria is very clever, if we can see clever between two quotes. They use the art. They recognize how much art is important to move people. So they figure out that if we manipulate the art, if we had some big names and artists join our view as a government and support us as a government, people will follow that. Now you can see in Syria, unfortunately, we have two kinds of art. One art pro-Assad, the president, and one art pro-humanity. Yesterday, one of my, I consider him teachers on the painting, he's very famous globally, Youssef Abdelki, they arrested him. He have never expressed his feeling against the government by writing. He was just painting. What he was painting? The faces of human beings, of Syrian people. Just from this, they arrested him because they understand the message. They know how much this is important. He was just painting faces of children, refugees, women, people around the Syria who are suffering. And there is no political statement, even though the government arrested him. Because now the government asking every artist to join the government and start to support the government because they know how much art, as Jihad said, important, and how the people follow the art and understand it much better, and it's really affected.
So the underground art, the art that is expressing the revolutionary point of view, how is that getting to people? Is the internet playing a big part of that? I mean, how are people seeing this?
Mm-hmm. Actually, the internet in Syria, you will be shocked that we don't really have a good access to internet. Just very few and limited areas, there is internet network in it, and just young people who are able to serve the internet. But the majority of the population, they are not able to use the internet. But we have noticed that after the revolution, if we have like a graph, people start to use an internet and to communicate much more in the media, social media, after the revolution, probably 100% more. So even all people start to use it and learn it because they have noticed that this is the only way, unfortunately, we can communicate and send a message and even organize ourselves as a movement. But still, it's not easy to get in the internet. With all these difficulties, people tend to go to the internet because we are not able to gather, we are not able to communicate in person, we are not able even to have a demonstration in the street, peaceful demonstration. So the only way actually to send a message or to tell that this atrocity happened, so the internet was the method of people to send a message, tell the whole world that this is happening in Syria and to communicate. Also, what we have to admit, there is another side of that. Everything in life, unfortunately, have two sides. The government also using the internet, and we have to admit they're using very efficiently. They have an army called the Electronic Army, and they are trying to mislead the community, mislead the whole international community, and even the people in Syria, to send the wrong message and to support a theory the government invented that there is a conspiracy against the government of Syria from all the world, and we have to fight against it, and we have to stand with the president.
Do you think, though, that people outside of Syria believe that message? Or are they more likely to believe what's happening on the revolutionary side? Because that's coming out in social media as mm-hmm. well. What do you think?
I've traveled the world, and unfortunately, people don't know about the other neighborhood. What would they know about the Middle East or a country in the Middle East? So when the government or anybody gives any videos or paintings or a poem or anything, they take it and they think this is the source, this is the real, this is the reality. And that's why our regime from the first beginning started to give this impression that we are facing or having a conspiracy, and second, we are attacked by Islamists and jihadists and people from, I don't know, I'm fundamentalists. So in order to impress the whole world that he's progressive and, I mean, a positive or, you know. So, yes, it's double-faced. And, I mean, people from all over the world have so many, these days, have so many sources that they're lost between in translation. They don't know what to believe, where's the truth, and who is telling the truth? Because I see so many of them. So, yes, and something about the artists, the art not only inside Syria, because so many artists have smuggled their paintings and their works outside, and we can see so many exhibitions in Europe, the United States, or other countries, maybe from the Arab world, who support any point of view.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming in and telling us just a little bit of your story this morning. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Fadia Afashay is a native of Damascus, Syria, and is a writer, celebrated painter, lawyer, and activist. Her husband, the actor Jay Abdo, is also Syrian and an activist as well. The couple currently lives and works in the United States. They were in Milwaukee last week to work with high school students attending Global Action Through Engagement, a high school program that's hosted by the Institute of World Affairs and Discovery Camps at UW-Milwaukee. There are links to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break now and then dive into the very cool ocean of moons that orbit the planet Neptune. We'll chat with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us this morning. And it's also great to have Gene Creighton with us to talk about things astronomical as she does for us each month. Welcome, Gene.
Hello, Bonnie.
Great to see you again.
Great to see you.
It has been so hot. And we have all probably been thinking about cool things. We've been trying to imagine ourselves in maybe water.
Yes. How about the Mediterranean?
Yeah, that sounds good. With a cool drink. And of course, that makes us think about Neptune, the god of the sea.
It does.
Which, if we're thinking in terms of astronomical things, makes us think in terms of the planet Neptune.
Yes.
And that is going to be our subject today because there is a new moon around Neptune, is there not?
There is. There's been an announcement that there is a new moon that hasn't been named yet. Its current working name is S/2004N1, which
not
I'm sure
exactly
will
poetical.
Change. No, it will. I think they give throwaway assignments so that nobody will feel sorry to see that one go. It's probably less than 12 miles across, so that would be the smallest of the moons around Neptune, and it is 100 million times fainter than the faintest star you can see with the naked eye.
So, wow, you really can't see it.
You cannot. This was seen with the help of the Hubble Space Telescope going over data that has been gathered over the years in that vicinity. And the fact of the matter is that these are so small, so dark, it's coal black in how it reflects light, so it's really, really hard to see. People have to use all the tricks in the book to identify individual objects. And if because it's so small, investigators have to go back to other data and see if their model is correct of what its orbit is, then they should be able to find it again. And they were finding it again in data before the data that discovered the moon in the first place. So that's encouraging.
Now, how do we know it's a moon versus, say, an asteroid?
We don't know that. There could easily, I mean, we expect that some of the objects that are traveling around Neptune, any of the planets, you could have captured objects. So we're pretty confident, for example, that the two moons of Mars are probably captured asteroids. Now, in the case of Neptune, this is the smallest of all the objects that I mentioned. There is a large percentage of the 14 now moons of Neptune that are moving in what we call retrograde orbits. Some of them are also highly inclined. In other words, their orbit has a great angle with respect to the plane of Neptune around the sun, and also their orbits are very elliptical. Those moons are likely not to have formed from the same goodies that Neptune did, but are likely to have been captured objects. So I have to say that I have a personal connection to Neptune.
Okay, what is it?
So in my mind, of course, it's Poseidona. So that's the Greek, Poseidon is the Greek version of Neptune, the original version of the god of the sea. And I have a very strong memory. In 1989, I was studying hard with a friend, and we heard somebody else talking about something they had seen on the television the night before. They had talked about this Voyager 2 that had flown by Neptune and had shown this amazing video, beautiful imagery of this blue sea-colored planet. And I thought to myself, I remember distinctly, wow, some people actually get to study that. Imagine that. So not much later, a few months later, I was talking with a professor. I was doing an undergraduate degree in physics at the University of Athens at the time. And I spoke to one of the professors there in the astronomy department. And apparently she thought it was a great idea to write a thesis on Neptune. So I got to work with all the articles that had come out from the Voyager 2 mission, and it sort of launched, in some ways, it launched my career. That's how I got really engaged with astronomy, because until then, although I was interested in astronomy, I didn't think that I would be able to become an astronomer, and that's what kind of clenched the deal, as it were.
So we can thank Neptune.
We can thank Neptune,
for you
right.
sitting right here and talking to us.
That's right.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So at that time, before Voyager 2 went to Neptune, we only knew of three of the moons of Neptune. We knew of Triton, and in fact, for quite a long time, and Proteus, and, well, I like the Greek word, Nereida.
That's pretty.
Yes, Nereida. So Nereida, unlike the other two that are sons, children of Neptune, according to mythology, Nereida was a whole class of sea creatures. And Neaves were the brook, river, sometimes near trees as well. But all these creatures were connected to water in some way. So those were the only three. And at the time before Voyager 2 data was analyzed, there was a large discussion about whether Neptune had rings or not. They knew from the data that they weren't complete rings. They looked more like sausages.
Okay. Yeah.
On a string, mm-hmm. as definite what they called ring arcs. So definitely thicker areas and almost nothing connecting to other thicker areas. So this was a great intriguing thing about Neptune that we really haven't seen anywhere else. It turns out that those really are ring arcs. In other words, there are ways of, for moons, we call them shepherd moons, to keep material not only confined in how broad it gets, but also how long it gets in the case of Neptune. But also in that debris, we found extra moons that we hadn't seen before. Because Voyager 2 got so close to Neptune, we were able to see many more moons. So that added five more to the mix. Can I tell you their names?
Yes, please, because I'm sure that they're just wonderful.
They're beautiful. And what can I say? I have two boys, so I couldn't give these names to them. But listen to this. Galatia, Vespina, Larissa, Thalassa. Thalassa, by the way, means sea in Greek. Neava.
They're beautiful.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
I think they're pretty awesome. So those were the five extras that we found. And then a few years passed, several years passed, in fact, before, from ground-based observations, we were able to find another group. But I feel that before we go on to those other five objects that are fairly small, I want to say something about Triton. Triton is the largest by far moon of Neptune. And what was very intriguing about it is that when we took pictures of the surface, it looked like there were some dark streaks. And people had no clue what those were. No idea. Eventually, we got lucky. And in one of the pictures, we saw some of the atmosphere almost in kind of like a cross section. And it became clear that there was amount of material that's escaping the surface of Triton. And because it has winds, Triton has an atmosphere, which is unusual for a moon, but it does. It's a very large moon. And it seems the wind seems to trail that a plume a very long distance, several miles. So even from above, you can see that streak of material against the surface. Now, what's cool about this is that this is kind of like a cold volcano. So Triton has cracks on the surface. It has trapped methane and ammonia under it. When the crack goes to the surface entirely, clear to the pocket of methane that's there, it is a very cold world, so it's not going to be liquid, but it goes from frozen to gas. So you get these explosions, these plumes of material coming from the surface.
Wow. Well, literally coming from well below the surface.
Yeah, of course. That's what I mean. Yeah.
But wow.
So an active world, even though at the time we thought it was the coldest world in the solar system at 38 degrees above absolute zero. So to give you a sense of what that means, water at those temperatures is as hard as steel. And you can't guess based on properties on our planet. You can't guess what materials are going to be like on Triton because it's so cold. You need different models. There's a whole science that basically looks at what are the properties of materials if you take them to extremely cold environments. Triton would be a good lab for that. So an extra group of moons were found. These were from ground-based observations, so from telescopes on Earth. They probably were scratching their heads. There is a whole committee that names objects to make sure that they're consistent with themes, but also to make sure that the name hasn't been used before. And that's a hard thing to do because there are a lot of asteroids, so a lot of names have been snapped up. But thankfully for us, some of the references, if you will, Homer, Hesiod, have whole lists of Nereids. So we have some names for them. Now, these would be Psamathi. So this is the goddess of sand. Niso, the goddess of islands. Alimivi is the lady of brine. Sao comes from the verb save, the equivalent of save in Greek. So that's, I think, since it's, Greece is such a nautical country, there's always a tendency to please and flatter the gods so that your people who are at sea are safe. And Laomedeia, which is the leader of people. So that, with the new one, which I'm sure will be named within the next year or two, is a total of 14 for Neptune.
So far.
Indeed, so far. This does change. We could have more over time.
Well, Jean, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the campus of UW-Milwaukee. She spoke to us this month about the moons of Neptune. We'll take one last break, and then we'll learn about a new quarterly poetry reading series that's taking place here in Milwaukee. So stick around. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. When was the last time you were at a poetry reading that felt as energized as a rock concert? Well, if you said never, two local poets are happy to change that. Paul Scott August and Robert Vaughn have recently teamed up to create new quarterly poetry events called the Middle Coast Poets Reading Series. They're carefully curating a list of the best poets in the tri-state area to bring a new vibe and a new audience to Milwaukee-based readings. With a successful April event under their belts, the pair are looking forward to a reading next Monday that features six poets. They tell Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce they were inspired to create the series after commiserating over a lack of regular poetry readings in Milwaukee, particularly the kind that Vaughn describes.
We were talking about, like, you know, kind of edgy, bar-oriented, fun, hanging out sort of readings. And there really is a lack of that here in the city. So yeah. We said, Paul, kind of, I think you were the one that looked at me and said, why don't we do it?
Yeah, just kind of made the mistake of saying, let's do it. It started as kind of a joke, and I discovered that making jokes with Robert is perilous because he will hold you to it. And 5 minutes later, we had paper out and pens, and we're planning it out and discussing which poets we wanted to bring into town and where we wanted to do it and how long it was going to be and who was going to read first. And 2 hours later, it was all set.
Now, the idea behind this is to, obviously, as the name implies, focus on Middle Coast poets. Why is that?
Well, we really wanted to look at the untapped talent that exists. I mean, we already know Milwaukee is a much more literary and artistic city than a lot of people even are, you know, willing to admit. I think a lot of people are like, oh, we have poets that live here? Ooh, wow.
Right.
There's just something about the energy of writers and poets coming together and discussing and hanging out and hearing people read, you know, hearing especially poets share their work. It's a very, I think, vital missing element from our culture.
And there are a lot of poets that both Robert and I now have met over the years who are located in driving distance to Milwaukee. Chicago, Madison, Minneapolis, Michigan. And we decided to bring together people we knew that we wanted to read with to Milwaukee in this reading series. Now, the term Middle Coast Poets came out. We needed a name for the reading series. Originally, it was just going to be a one-off thing in April for National Poetry Month. And then we got so excited about it, we decided to make it a quarterly reading series. So we went on the internet and we Googled nicknames for Milwaukee. And everything was taken already. You know, for example, Third Coast.
Right.
Well, there's
a
Third Coast magazine here in Milwaukee. There's also a Third Coast literary magazine up in Michigan. Cream City is used 10,000 ways. And so we're looking for something different. And one of the names about 10 down the list was Middle Coast. And we looked at each other, talked about it, and thought, hey, no one's using that. So that's how the name came about.
I'm curious, why, if Milwaukee does have this really strong, sometimes untapped reservoir of talent, particularly in poetry, why there wasn't a reading series already? What do you think is maybe going on there?
There has been several reading series in the past that just never really took off. I used to attend a few, and unfortunately, the names even escape me now. They were in people's houses. There was a loft in Walker's Point I used to go to once a month where they brought in poets from around the country. And that lasted for a while. And I don't know if it's either a lack of interest or the person running it moved on to something else.
But we really wanted to create something that was unique. And hopefully, even if we're not the people at the helm a year from now, that there'll be somebody still wanting to do it. You know, that there's this momentum forward for the readings.
Well, so who's your, I guess, target audience in creating this series? I mean, is it fellow writers like yourselves, or is
Hopefully
it really?
Not.
They're the most critical. Are you kidding?
Well, when I say hopefully not about local writers, is one of the things about poetry is people say the only people buying poetry books are other poets, which limits your audience. So we're hoping it's more than. I mean, yes, we want to bring in our fellow writers. Not just poets, but fellow writers in general. But we want to bring in people who maybe have never been to a poetry reading before and they would like it enough to come back. At our first reading, we had a woman came who had never been to a reading before, and she brought her aunt and her uncle and her grandmother. And they all had a great time. And one of the reasons we picked bars as our venue was that we figured that people would maybe show up to have a drink out of curiosity and then stay for the reading.
Right. So not like the bongo drums and coffee house type traditionally get.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. One of the things we're doing is we're switching quarterly between River West and Bayview was the idea we came up with. So our first reading back in April was at the Public House on Locust, and it was fantastic. And we actually had 10 poets read and about 50 people show up. And it was a packed house and it was a loud, raucous house that really got into the poetry.
How are you responding to what people typically conceive of when they think of a poetry reading to get them to actually take that leap and go out if they've never been before?
I think the venues are going to help. If you have people who are going to be at the venue anyhow, whether they're there because of happy hour or drink specials, and all of a sudden somebody goes to a microphone and starts reading poetry, they're going to be surprised at how much fun it is. There was a location in Bayview that I went to a reading at just because of social networking. I heard about it at the last minute, and it was a poet from Kentucky. And he was driving around in his car with a trunk full of books hitting bars in different cities. And it was a bar that has like 150 different imports. So it was crowded for people drinking beer. And this guy who is a very large, imposing man walked through the microphone and started reading poetry. And the room just loved it. And it was, I was shocked that these people that I thought would walk out pulled their chairs up closer and sat down and said, I don't know what this is, but I want to watch it. And that's, we hope, those kind of people we can grab and they'd come back.
Tell me about the energy of the night of your first reading. You know, well, was it like that with that kind of, you know, drawing people in?
I really feel like it was. Yeah. I mean, and I also feel like the crowd stayed. You know, they didn't necessarily come for Nikki, who read first, Nikki Walschlager.
Yes.
You know, she read this really kind of long, prosy poem, beautiful, beautiful piece. And I sort of thought, okay, the people that are here for Nikki are going to take off. You know, like that's typical in a reading, like that you have your group. And they didn't. People stayed right through till the end. We even took a break halfway through. People stuck around. They had got more drinks, beers, whatever. I really feel like a lot of it also has to do with the quality of the people. I mean, Paul, the people we're booking to do the readings, at least right now, are people that we either are familiar with their work because we have online access to them, or they're people that we know. And I think in that way, we are measuring a certain aspect of quality, hopefully, you know, that not necessarily in terms of their public arena of how they present their work, but at least, you know, the work that we're attracted to or drawn to.
Well, yeah, tell me a little bit more about the process of how you decide who's going to be reading at these and how you make sure that you're having that representation from all over the Middle Coast, if you will.
Well, what we did is we started a Facebook page for Middle Coast poets. So look it up, like the page, come join us. And then many poets were sending us messages saying, I'd be available for October. I'll be available next spring. And these are poets with several books out who are quite accomplished writers and readers. So it's a mix of that and people that we just know. And sometimes it's just people who someone we know suggests. I sent a bunch of messages to poets that I know. And I said, who would you like to come see read? And they sent some names back. So we have this reading coming up on July 29th at Bernhardt's in Bayview. We have six poets reading, three of them from Milwaukee and three of them from Madison. Now, why we pick these six, I've read their books, I have their books, and I've enjoyed them. And not just me, other people I know have their books too. And when I say so-and-so is going to be reading, I get the good reaction of, oh, I read his book, I'll be there.
There's a certain element too, I think, in addition to all that great stuff Paul's talking about, that's the uncertain element. You know, there's always – Paul and I both come from performing in bands when we were younger, and I think there's always that element of the unknown that's going to happen in any event, and that's the exciting part to me. We don't know how someone's going to get up and present their work, and we don't know how someone following this person is going to be in terms of like what the theme of that work was to this, you know, like or the narrative style or the lyrical content or whatever. What I love is how, you know, it speaks to so much potential.
Paul, you've talked about how you've read a lot of these poets to begin with, but as Robert just mentioned, there's always that unknown as to how that poet is going to perform their work. Did you find yourselves being surprised hearing how certain works that you'd maybe read before were being spoken out loud?
I think so. The surprise, I think, came more in because we had 10 poets initially for the first reading, and I didn't know all of them. Some of them I knew by reputation but had never read or seen read before. So the surprise came with somebody that I really didn't know read something that just totally blew me away. And then they were followed by somebody with a completely different style who kind of fed off them. It's kind of like having a bunch of opening bands of, you know, a folk band followed by a jazz band followed by a blues band. You know, you feed off each other and you get away from the idea that, oh, I only like jazz, so I don't want to listen to them. And there's people who might think I only like narrative poetry, and then they hear somebody do a slam style poem and they're like, wow, you could do that? The other thing that we did in the first reading, and I think this was really nice, is we asked each poet to open up with a poem by another poet.
Oh, that's an interesting concept.
So we asked each poet to bring a poem that speaks to you, either it influenced you or it's just a poem that is like you or like your work or just something that you love. And the surprise came and certain people would read a poem and you'd be like, I didn't know that they liked that type of poem. And I got to hear poems that I wouldn't have normally found from other poets.
The other thing too, and Paul didn't really talk about this, but we did spend a certain amount of time saying, would Britney be better before so-and-so? Would, you know, looking
at the order, yeah.
You know, what we knew about them. And if we didn't know anything, it gave us the impetus to go and like look up their work and stuff. But who follows who in a successful way? Who would be a good opener? Who would grab the attention right away? You know, like those kinds of things are really important. And that came, I think, from our background.
It was like a set list.
Yeah.
You know, we keep going back to the music thing. One of the ideas of reading other poets' poems was like doing a cover song. You know, what cover song would Robert do? What cover song would Paul do? And so we picked poets that way. But we also did spend a lot of time, you know, how many songs in a set? How many poems will the first poet read? Who will follow them? Not just boy, girl, but will his style work with her style? Well, who would be good to end the first set, the first five poets, followed by the next five poets? Who will open? Who will MC? We discussed which one of us would be better MC for the first half versus the second half. So a lot of thought went into that. I think that's why the first one was so successful, is we put a lot of thought into it, I think, beyond what a normal poetry reading would be, where somebody just says, well, we got some poets, and they throw a microphone up in front and hope it works.
It's like a rock concert of poetry.
That works. I like that idea.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, tell me about this upcoming event. Who you have booked so far?
We have six poets. There's three from Milwaukee. Robert Vaughn sitting here to my left. Michael Seidel and Laurel Landis are the Milwaukee poets.
All familiar names
yes.
on this program.
And then from Madison, we have Sean Bishop, Matthew Gwinnett, and Kara Candido.
Robert Vaughn, Paul Scott August, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thanks for having
Stephanie.
Us.
Robert Vaughn and Paul Scott August are the co-creators of the Middle Coast Poets Reading Series. The second quarterly reading will be this Monday at 6 p.m. at Bernhardt's in Bayview. Vaughn leads roundtables at Redbird Red Oak Writing Studio and is the senior flash fiction editor at JMWW and Lost in Thoughts magazines. He's also the author of the chapbook Microtones, and his first full-length collection, Attics and Basements, will be published in February 2014. Wauwatosa resident Paul Scott August is a poet and software developer and former poetry editor at the Cream City Review. Twice nominated for a Pushcart Prize, his poetry has been published in dozens of magazines and journals, and he blogs at Poetry Saved My Life. You can find more information about their event from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your morning. Join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.